Today I would like to talk about the behavior of stellar systems in the centers of galaxies. This, of course, is M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, with an overall scale of the stellar disk of about 10 kiloparsecs. The highest resolution image we have comes from the Hubble telescope with a scale of, with a resolution of a fraction of a parsec. And what I'll be talking about is the behavior of the stellar systems on the smallest scales that we can resolve near the centers of galaxies. Of course, the best example is not M31, but our own galaxy. This is an infrared image showing the region near the radio source Sagittarius A star, which is in the middle of this small box. And the radio source is believed to represent the center of the galaxy. The reason these systems are interesting is because they're the densest known stellar systems. So for example, at a radius of a tenth of a parsec from Sagittarius A star, the stellar density is about 10 to the eighth times higher than it is in the vicinity of the sun. One of the reasons that's important is that in contrast to the gas in this room, which is in thermal equilibrium, the stars in the large parts of galaxies, and particularly in the neighborhood of the sun, are not in thermodynamic equilibrium. The time required to achieve a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution near the sun is 10 to the 14th years, much longer than the age of the galaxy. But if you go closer to the centers of galaxies, because the density is so much higher, the relaxation time is shorter. And once you're within about 10 parsecs from the galactic center, that is everywhere inside this image, the relaxation time is shorter than the age of the galaxy. And so one should expect to find some kind of statistical equilibrium here. And we would like to understand in what sense this is in thermodynamic equilibrium. And finally, of course, the center of a galaxy is the bottom of the potential well. And just like archaeologists go to garbage dumps of ancient towns to find interesting things, astronomers can go to the centers of galaxies to look for interesting things, and in particular, to look for black holes, which are interesting because they will provide sources for gravitational radiation, hopefully within the next decade that we can detect. And once we detect that gravitational radiation, they'll provide a laboratory for testing general relativity and the strong field limit for testing general relativity and the strong field limit, for testing that the Kerr metric is the correct solution, correct description of gravity near the event horizon of a black hole. Let me start by reminding you of the reasons why we think that there are black holes in the centers of galaxies. The basic reason comes from active galactic nuclei, the small fraction of galaxies that contain a bright central source of non-stellar radiation. Of these, the most luminous are the quasars. The quasars can produce 10 to the 13th times the solar luminosity, or up to 1,000 times the luminosity of the whole galaxy from this small active nucleus at the center. Because quasars are so bright, they were the first objects found at redshifts of order unity. And as a result of large surveys, in particular the Sloan Sky Survey, we now have a good picture of the evolution of the co-moving number density of quasars as a function of redshift, or as a function of time since the Big Bang. There's a strong peak near redshifts of 2 to 3, and the current number density is down by almost two orders of magnitude from the density at the peak. So most quasars have, there was an active quasar phase early in the history of the universe, and most of those quasars have disappeared. We now believe that the energy source for quasars is accretion of material onto a massive black hole. The most luminous quasars appear to correspond to black holes of around 10 to the 10th solar masses. And so for reference, the Schwarzschild radius, or the radius of the event horizon, for a black hole of, say, 10 to the ninth solar masses is about 20 astronomical units, or roughly the distance between the Sun and Uranus. So these objects are putting out luminosity equivalent to 10 to the 13th solar luminosities from a volume not much bigger than the size of the solar system. The reasons that we believe, there are many reasons why we believe that quasars are powered by massive black holes. So I'll give a very brief summary. One is relativistic motions in jets coming from active galactic nuclei. This is the jet from M87 in the Virgo cluster. If you track it in the radio over a period of 5 years, the blobs in the jet can be traced. They appear to be moving at velocities several times the speed of light. This is a perspective effect that you would expect, but only if the material is actually moving at close to the speed of light. The only way we know to accelerate something, these masses of material to the near the speed of light, is in a relativistic potential well, and that requires a black hole. The second argument comes from gravitational microlensing. This is a galaxy which happens to have a background quasar aligned almost with the center of the galaxy, and the gravitational field from the center of the galaxy splits the background quasar into four images. If you plot the flux from these images as a function of time over several years, they vary independently. Since these are the same images of the same quasar, the only way they can vary independently, apart from an overall time delay, is if if gravitational lensing is occurring as a result of individual stars passing through the line of sight to the quasar, individual stars from the host galaxy. Those stars will only generate substantial magnification if the size of the emitting region is comparable to the Einstein radius, which in this case is the geometric mean of the Schwarzschild radius of the star and the distance to the star. That implies an upper limit to the size of the emitting region, that is to the size of the quasar, of less than about 70 astronomical units. That's consistent with, but somewhat smaller than, less rigorous limits from the intrinsic variability of quasars on timescales of weeks, which requires that the size is less than the light travel time. That the size is small enough so that the light travel time is less than the variability time, and that gives a somewhat larger but still very small limit. That size is so small as to require that the power source is a black hole, because we don't know of anything else small enough to emit radiation like that. And it's tantalizing that these numbers are not that far from the size of the event horizon. X-ray spectroscopy in a few cases of active galactic nuclei exhibits a very strong and clear iron line. There's the rest wavelength of the line, and this broad tail results from redshifted iron emission. The emission is redshifted both because of the gravitational potential, presumably of the black hole, and because of the relativistic speeds of the accretion disk around the black hole. This can be modeled, and the models require that this emission is coming from within a few times the event horizon of the black hole. And again, we don't know of any other mechanism that can produce a spectral line of this shape. The final argument is simply one of efficiency. The natural efficiency for any power source is the ratio of the energy it emits to the rest mass that it consumes. For standard nuclear reactions, the efficiency is less than 1%, but accretion from a thin disk onto a non-rotating or a rotating black hole can give efficiencies of between 6% and, in extreme cases, up to 40%. These are the most efficient engines that we know of, and the luminosity of quasars is so great that the only way we can supply that energy with a reasonable amount of fuel is the kind of efficiency that you can get from accretion onto a black hole. So if you believe that quasars are powered by accretion onto a black hole. And we know that the present co-moving number density of quasars is several orders of magnitude less than it was at redshifts of 2 to 3, and that quasars are found in the centers of galaxies. The inevitable consequence is that the centers of many nearby galaxies should contain black holes at their centers, the black holes that used to be quasars but presumably are no longer shining, either because they have no fuel or because they're accreting the fuel in some radiatively inefficient process. Well, why look in the centers of galaxies for these objects? We don't have high enough resolution to know that quasars are exactly in the centers of galaxies. But again, the center is the bottom of the potential well, so it's natural that a massive black hole might be found there. The second not so good reason is that, in fact, that's the only place we can find them. Although we've found many black holes at the centers of galaxies, if they weren't at the centers, there might be others not at the centers that we have no mechanism for locating. And finally, there is the process of dynamical friction, which is a collisionless damping process analogous to Landau damping in plasmas that causes the orbits of massive bodies to spiral to the center of a stellar system. The simplest way to think about dynamical friction is that if you have a massive object traveling through a stellar system, as it travels through the stellar system, it will give its gravitational force will give impulses to the stars that it passes that will cause the stellar orbits to bend towards the body, and that will create an enhanced density wake. These are the contours of that wake from a simple calculation. Because the wake is behind the body rather than in front of it, it continually attracts the body backwards, continually removes orbital energy, and causes any massive body to spiral to the center of the system. You can work out the time scales for orbital decay from dynamical friction. For example, in M31, a 10 to the 6th solar mass object would decay into the center from roughly this region, 10 to the 7th from here, 10 to the 8th from here. So one reason to look in the centers of galaxies is that if you have any massive black hole anywhere in the body of the galaxy, it will tend to spiral towards the center in a time scale less than the age of the galaxy. The consequence of that is that since we believe galaxies are formed by hierarchical formation process, if two galaxies with black holes at their centers merge, then the two black holes will spiral together and perhaps eventually merge. That suggests that it may be quite common to have binary black holes at the centers of galaxies. The situation is slightly more complicated than that. It turns out that although dynamical friction is very efficient in the body of the galaxy as the two black holes spiral together and become bound to one another and start to speed up, the frictional effects become less efficient as the speed of the binary increases. That means that if you take realistic galaxies and plot the orbital decay time as a function of orbital radius for two black holes, this is a slightly complicated plot, but for example, this is a plot for two black holes of the same mass in a set of axisymmetric galaxy models that are intended to model a sample of 30 or 40 nearby galaxies. This plots the orbital radius in parsecs. This plots the characteristic decay time. The decay time is relatively long in the outer parts, but still shorter than the Hubble time. It gets shorter and shorter, and then as the black holes get close enough to become bound at radii of a few parsecs, the decay time gets longer and longer until finally at very small radii, gravitational radiation takes over and the decay time becomes very short. In all of these cases, appears to be a region in which many of the decay times are longer than Hubble time, and that suggests that the binary black holes may hang up or stop at these characteristic radii between about a tenth of a parsec and between about a tenth of a parsec and a thousandth of a parsec, and there may be a large population of binary black holes that are very difficult to detect but still present in the centers of many galaxies. This could even be true in our own galaxy, but at least at the moment, we have no direct evidence for a binary black hole there. The highest resolution evidence we have on the black hole in the center of our galaxy comes from astrometric observations in the near infrared, both from a group in Los Angeles and a group in Munich. These are plots of the positions of stars close to Sagittarius A star over the astrometric measuring campaigns, which have lasted for about 15 years. It's very encouraging that the two independent groups get the same orbits for the stars with the shortest orbital periods, and even for the stars with longer orbital periods, where the orbital shape, the best fit orbits of the two groups don't agree, the positions of the data points agree very well. This is an image from the Munich group, basically showing a movie of the motions of these stars over the last 15 years. You can see that the center of attraction that the stars move around is very close to Sagittarius A star and appears to coincide with Sagittarius A star. The typical orbit size is about 1,000 astronomical units, but the smallest paracenter is only about 100 astronomical units. And the orbital period is only 16 years. That's this red star. The crucial fact is that the orbit of the red star and all the other stars appears to be closed. Closed orbit is a characteristic of a Kepler or a point mass potential. And since the orbit's closed, the size of the central mass, whatever it is, must be smaller than the paracenter distance. That is smaller than 100 astronomical units, which once again implicates a black hole. The astrometric measurements give an estimate of the mass of the black hole, which is 4 × 10^6 solar masses within a few percent, and a somewhat less accurate estimate of the distance to the galactic center. Again, this is only about a 5% measurement, but it's probably the most accurate measurement we have of the distance to the galactic center. With this constraint on the size of the black hole, on the size of the central mass, the only alternatives to a black hole are either a boson star made of some hypothetical elementary particle that we've never seen and have no other evidence for, or a cluster of something like 10^10 Jupiter mass black holes, which seems very difficult to make. These are the limits on a possible binary black hole in the galactic center. There's a variety of constraints, that the gravitational radiation timescale should not be too short, that it shouldn't make the orbits of the S stars obviously non-Keplerian. There are constraints from the proper motion and position of Sagittarius A star, but you can see that a binary is quite possible as long as the mass ratio is less than about 1% and the semi-major axis is between about a 1/1000th of a parsec and a fraction of a parsec. So there may be a binary black hole in the galactic center, but we have no direct evidence. The other really strong evidence for a black hole, which I'll review briefly, is in the galaxy NGC 4258. It's a rather ordinary looking galaxy, but it has a weak active galactic nucleus. The nucleus contains a disk of material surrounding it, which exhibits some Maser emission. There's blue-shifted Maser emission and red-shifted Maser emission on these two sides. The velocities of the Maser spots exhibit a perfect Keplerian rotation curve, which allows you to estimate the mass of the central object and constrains the size of the central object to be less than about 1/10 of a parsec. There is also Maser emission from the line of sight between the active galactic nucleus and the Earth. The Maser spots in this from this region exhibit proper motions, which gives you an independent measure of the kinematics of the disk. They also exhibit a radial drift of about 10 kilometers per second per year, which is the centripetal acceleration towards the central object. The combination of these three measurements, the proper motion, the acceleration, and the Keplerian rotation curve, allows you to estimate both the mass of the central object and the distance to NGC 4258 twice independently. The two estimates are consistent at the level of about a 2%. And these are actually now the most accurate distance estimates we have for any extragalactic object. There is one of the great promises for the next decade is the discovery of more of these objects. This is just a proof in principle that there is another object exhibiting Maser emission with this characteristic Keplerian rotation curve and spots in the line of sight to the quasar. The advantage of this particular galaxy is that it's about 7 or 8 times further away than NGC 4258. That means that this galaxy is in the Hubble flow, and measurement of the distance to this to the same accuracy as we have for NGC 4258 would give a direct one-step determination of the Hubble constant. The consequences of this, some of the consequences of this are that we now have, although these are the two best black hole mass determinations we have somewhat less accurate, but still I think reliable estimates from about 40 to 50 other galaxies. Some of these come from the Maser disks, some of from the kinematics of gas disks, and some from stellar dynamics in the centers of these galaxies. Roughly speaking, when you do this, you find that the black hole mass correlates quite closely with either the total luminosity of the galaxy for elliptical galaxies or the luminosity of the bulge component of the galaxy for spirals. And a rough rule of thumb is that the mass of the central black hole is about 0.2% of the total mass of stars in the galaxies. The different symbols here indicate different methods of determining masses. There's no systematic offset between the different methods, which suggests that they're all getting roughly the correct masses. An even better correlation is with the velocity dispersion of the host galaxy. Roughly speaking, the mass of the black hole goes like the fourth power of the dispersion, and this allows you to predict black hole masses in elliptical galaxies with a scatter of about 0.3 in the log. Most of these masses come from the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Telescope's capability for measuring black hole masses, I think, has now largely been exhausted, but there is promise of new measurements, again, from searches for new Maser disks, very long baseline interferometry, and by replacing the Hubble with laser guide star adaptive optics on ground-based telescopes. So there is some hope that these measurements can be improved over the next decade. One additional piece of evidence that these other measurements are correct comes from, again, from the galaxy NGC 4258, which has a very accurate mass from the Masers. You can try to estimate the mass of the black hole in this galaxy from the dynamics of the stars around the central disk. This is actually much harder than it is in most elliptical galaxies because this is a late type spiral with dust obscuration, color gradients, and lots of other unpleasant problems. However, if you do try to go ahead and do this, you get a chi-squared fit for the mass of the black hole, which exhibits a quite well-determined black hole mass. Depending on the model that you choose, the methods you correct for the dust extinction, you get a range of masses between about 2.5 and 3.5 times 10 to the 7th solar masses. The best fit, the best model is about 20% lower than the black hole mass from the Masers. Although obviously you'd like that agreement to be better, I think this is strong evidence that most of the masses in here determined from good data are quite reliable. Okay, well, most of this has been an introduction. I've just been trying to summarize the current state of our understanding about black holes in the centers of galaxies. The summary would be that most galaxies appear to contain 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th solar mass black holes at their centers, although what you actually see is some sort of massive dark object. We're far from resolving the event horizon, but in many cases, there's simply no other astrophysical object that we know of that this could be other than a black hole. And in any case, we believe that the black holes are necessary because of the quasar, because we need a power source for the quasars. In fact, quantitatively, the local density of black holes that we measure from Hubble observations of nearby galaxies is consistent with the expected density of ash of dead black dead quasars left over from the quasar era at redshift 2 if the quasar efficiency is around 10 to 30%, and that's exactly the range of efficiency that you expect for thin disk accretion onto a black hole. So all of these arguments hang together remarkably well. It also appears that the black hole mass is correlated with the properties of the galaxies, in particular that the black hole mass is about 0.2% of the mass of stars. This is a very small fraction of the mass of stars, but recall that in creating the black hole, you have to release an energy that's of order mc squared. So the energy that's been released from the formation of the black hole is much bigger than the energy that's been released in forming the rest of the galaxy. If there is some sort of feedback between the energy released by the black hole and the rest of the formation process, then it's likely that there's a link between black hole formation and galaxy formation. That would be suggested also by the fact that the black hole mass is so well correlated with the properties of the galaxy. The nature of this link is still not known, and in particular, the most basic question is, do the galaxy properties determine the black hole mass, or does the feedback from the black hole stop galaxy formation at a particular size? We don't know which of these is correct. This is a really interesting and important subject for galaxy formation, but at the moment, this link between black hole formation and galaxy formation is still not understood. So I'd like to now turn from talking about the black holes to talking about the behavior of the stellar system that surrounds them. There are many interesting aspects to this interaction, but I'm just going to focus on these three subjects in the rest of the talk. The subject of hypervelocity stars dates back to a really wonderful paper written by Jack Hills back in the 1980s. This was, of course, before there was any good evidence for black holes in the centers of galaxies, but at that time he pointed out that if you had a black hole in the center of the Milky Way and a tightly bound binary star came close to the black hole, the binary star could be disrupted by the tidal field from the black hole. If that happened, one of the components of the binary would go into a much more tightly bound orbit around the black hole, and the second component could be shot out at very high velocity. Hills estimated that the maximum escape speed from the black hole could be up to a few thousand kilometers per second. And he pointed out that if such stars are passing out through the galaxy and you could detect even one, it would provide very strong and direct evidence for the existence of a central black hole. You can work this out quantitatively. The maximum speed of the velocity, maximum speed of the escaped star will be roughly the velocity, the orbital speed of the binary times the ratio of the black hole mass to the mass of the stars to the 1/6 power. If you're bored during the talk, I recommend you try that as a homework exercise. This is not the only possible way of generating very high velocity stars. Instead of a binary star and a single black hole, if you have a binary black hole and a single star passes between the two components of the black hole, you can have a slingshot effect that will also send the star out at very high speed. Before describing the observations, let me just put this in the context of the geometry of the galaxy. This is a two-mass picture of our own galaxy, but it's pretty much what the galaxy would look like if we were external to it, with the sun there, 8 kiloparsecs from the center, the black hole there, and then, of course, what would happen if there's a is that the black hole may be ejecting hypervelocity stars at somewhere between 500 and 1,000 kilometers per second in all directions. How would you detect these? Well, first, you look high above the galactic plane so that there's less confusion with other stars. You look for young stars because the young massive stars are going to be easier to detect at large distances, and also if you see a young star up in the galactic halo, you know there's something strange about it because there's no recent star formation in the halo. Obviously, you look for something moving at high speed. If the stars are at very large distances, most of the speed will be radial velocity, so you can find them in spectroscopic surveys. Closer to the galactic center, you would be you can use large proper motion surveys to look for the hypervelocity stars. And obviously, one of the clues is if you see stars at high speed, they have to be moving out. If you see stars at high speed moving in towards the center of the galaxy or not moving out from the galactic center, there has to be some other explanation. Well, the first of these was found in a survey by Warren Brown and his collaborators at the Center for Astrophysics. They found a main sequence star that they identified from a set in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey catalog. It was at a distance of a little over 100 kiloparsecs and with a velocity in the galactic rest frame of 700 kilometers per second. For comparison, remember that the velocity of the sun around the center is about 220 kilometers per second, and the escape speed from the solar neighborhood is maybe around 500 or 600 kilometers per second. So this really is a rather high velocity. Brown et al. Now have surveyed many more stars. This is a histogram of velocities in the rest frame of the galaxy for a sample of young stars between 25 and 100 kiloparsecs. You can see what you would normally expect, that is a more or less Gaussian distribution centered near zero. However, if you go out past around 2 sigma in the Gaussian, at negative velocities, that is radial velocities coming towards us, there are only 2 stars out beyond 2 sigma. At positive velocities, they have 26 stars out beyond 2 sigma. And so the natural contention is that a significant fraction of these 26 stars at speeds up to around 800 kilometers per second are hypervelocity stars ejected from the black hole in the galactic center. So what's the evidence that this is really the correct mechanism for these? Well, the stellar lifetimes of the young stars in this survey are less than 5 times 10 to the 8th years. They have to be formed relatively recently. You can't form them in place because there's no star formation in the halo. On the other hand, given the velocities, the times these take to travel from the galactic center are less than 2 times 10 to the 8th years. So it's quite plausible that they could have been formed in the galactic center and then ejected. You can estimate roughly the rate at which these stars have to be formed. You get about 1 per million years. And that's, again, roughly consistent with the theoretical evidence, theoretical predictions given the number of binary stars and the distribution of stars near the central black hole. Again, all the velocities are positive. They're all traveling outward, which was a prediction of Hills's mechanism. And if these are ejected at a uniform rate, then roughly you expect that the number of stars inside some radius should be proportional to that radius. The statistics are obviously not very good, but roughly speaking, consistent with number going like radius. And for comparison, the overall distribution of stars in the static halo, the density goes like 1 over r cubed, so the number rises much more slowly than this. So all of that looks pretty persuasive. There is some reason for concern. There are other high-velocity stars, runaway stars, that can be produced if a supernova goes off in a binary system. Those are probably not the explanation, both because runaway stars have much lower kick velocities, less than about 200 kilometers per second, and because the rate of producing binary stars is too low by a factor of 100 or so. These surveys have turned up occasional stars that don't fit very well. These are 2 examples. In this particular case, the problem is that the proper motion measurement indicates that the origin of the star was the outer disk, not the galactic center. But you know, I think there has been a history among astronomers of sometimes underestimating errors in proper motion. So you know, more data is really needed. There's another one whose travel time is much longer than its lifetime. It's close to the Large Magellanic Cloud. Perhaps it came from a black hole in the Magellanic Cloud, but we just don't know if there are any, if there's a massive black hole in the cloud. Another possibility is that a dwarf galaxy has passed close to the center of the galaxy and been tidally disrupted and generated the spray of stars. These could have high velocities because the dwarf galaxy may have fallen in from well outside the galactic halo. The difficulty is that if these stars were produced in a single event and sprayed out with a range of velocities, you'd expect something like a Hubble flow, that is the ones at the largest distances should have the highest velocities. They all started at the same time. So constant travel time would be a single line on this diagram which plots velocity against distance, and you can see there's not much evidence for any sort of of the expected variation of velocity with distance. One of the attractive features of hypervelocity stars is that we'll learn much more in the future. There are huge new photometric and radial velocity surveys, such as the RAVE survey and the PanSTARRS survey. They should discover a lot more of these objects. High-resolution spectroscopy should yield chemical abundances. They ought to have the chemical abundance characteristic of the galactic center rather than, say, of the outer disk. And ultimately, very accurate proper motions, either from the Hubble telescope in the short term or from Gaia or SIM in the long term, will enable us to trace the orbits back and see if they really are at the galactic center. For comparison, the typical difference between something that came from the solar radius and something from the galactic center is about half a milliarcsecond per year, which is measurable now with the Hubble telescope. The two possible models, ejection by a single binary black hole and ejection of disruption of binaries by a single mass, single black hole, can be distinguished. They predict different values for the stellar rotation. This model predicts that there shouldn't be any binary hypervelocity stars because they've been disrupted. One predicts an isotropic distribution on the sky, and the other predicts an anisotropic distribution. So we should even be able to tell the difference between these two formation models. Okay, let me move on to the say something about this issue of what we expect the statistical equilibrium to be in a dense stellar system. If you really believe that gravitational interactions between the stars should generate statistical equilibrium, then we know from statistical mechanics that you would expect in a Keplerian gravitational potential that the number density should be just like an isothermal atmosphere, the exponential of minus potential over kT, where k is Boltzmann's constant. That implies a distribution that goes like the exponential of a constant times one over the radius. That clearly doesn't apply because this gives a hugely divergent number density close to the black hole. The reason it doesn't apply is that the black hole consumes stars that come too close to it. And once you include the disruption of stars eaten by the black hole, the correct solution becomes a power law, number density going like radius to the minus 7/4, which can also be derived pretty simply on the back of an envelope. And that's confirmed both by Fokker-Planck calculations, starting with an initial density distribution like this. As time goes on, it evolves towards this predicted power law distribution. So this might apply in the galactic center, but it's very difficult to test, both because there's a wide range of masses of stars. We don't know the distribution of masses, and this only works for a single mass population. Because there's recent star formation, and those stars may not be in equilibrium, and because there are likely to be remnants, black holes and neutron stars that we can't see at all, we don't know what their effect would be. This gives an orientation towards the timescales that we're talking about as a function of radius from the galactic center. There's the orbital period, radius of the event horizon, the two-body relaxation time, which is short compared to the age, or comparable to the age, over most of the region inside a few parsecs. And these are the characteristic times for relativistic precession and lens-tearing precession. You can see that at the radius of the S stars, both the relativistic precession and the expected Newtonian precession from the gravitational field of the other stars are a few million years. That suggests that with very accurate astrometry, over a period of some decades, we might be able to detect both of these, although disentangling the two of them may actually be quite difficult. There is, however, another kind of relaxation in the galactic center, sometimes called resonant relaxation, on timescales that are much longer than the orbital period. If you took a time exposure, the stellar orbit should look like a disk or an annulus. The star is precessing, and so the inner radius and outer radius of the annulus would be the pericenter and apocenter of the star. So if you think of each star as a disk on rather long timescales, then every disk is exerting a torque on every other disk. Those torques are causing the disks to precess. And if you have a large number of disks instead of mutual precession, you'll get a kind of relaxation. But it'll be a relaxation that affects only the direction of the angular momentum, the orbit normal, but not either the semi-major axis of the orbit or the eccentricity. And from the simple order of magnitude arguments, you can work out roughly what the relaxation time for this process should be. If you plot it on the same diagram, it's far shorter than the two-body relaxation time. And even for relatively young stars at distances we can resolve, it's short enough that these stars should be approaching a state of thermodynamic equilibrium under this process. The correct way to calculate what that distribution would be to do a numerical calculation of the interaction potential energy between any two stars, which would depend on the semi-major axes and eccentricities and the angle between the orbit normals, and then to make a microcanonical ensemble or a canonical ensemble and see what the distribution looks like. A very simple way to get some feeling for what happens is just to assume that all the stars have the same mass, they all have the same eccentricity, they all have the same semi-major axis, and then this number depends only on the angle between them, so you can expand this in spherical harmonics, and then I'll just drop all the spherical harmonics bigger than 2. And then the Hamiltonian is just a constant times the sum over all the stars of the pairwise squared cosine of the angle between them. And you can just ask, what's the thermodynamic equilibrium of a system with that Hamiltonian? This is actually a system that's been looked at in condensed matter physics. It's called the Mayer-Sope model, and it applies to liquid crystals. You find that this Hamiltonian does generate a phase transition. Above a particular temperature, the only equilibrium is spherical. Below a critical temperature given by that value, you split into two phases. There's a thickened disk. As the temperature decreases, the disk becomes thinner and thinner. There's also a couple of unstable phases up here. So basically, this says that you expect that there can be a phase transition in a relaxed system with two phases, one a disk phase and the other a spherically symmetric phase. The relevance of all this to the galactic center is that there has been the discovery of a disk of stars in the galactic center. There are roughly 100 massive young stars found in the central parsec of the galaxy. These are at much larger radii than the radius containing the stars for which you have orbits, but you can measure proper motions and radial velocities, so you have 5 of the 6 phase space coordinates. The age of the disk is only a few million years. And the reason that you believe that it's a disk is that with 5 of the 6 phase space coordinates, you have all 3 velocity components, and you find that all the velocity components lie close to a common plane, which suggests a disk. This can be illustrated a little more carefully, a little more closely with this little movie. The idea behind the movie is that it shows the probability distribution of the orbit normals of all these stars on a latitude-longitude map. We have a moving window that goes out in radius from the inside of the disk to the outside of the disk. This is at the smallest range of radii, and you can see that the orbit normals are concentrated in one part of the latitude-longitude diagram, suggesting that there was a clean, well-defined disk at small radii. This is just the right is just a contour plot of the left. But what you can also see is as the moving window goes out from small radii to large radii, the disk becomes much less well-defined. It starts to become lumpy. There's some evidence for a second disk. If you watch this carefully, you can see right about here, there's evidence that there might be a less well-defined second disk. The way this is conventionally interpreted is by saying that there's a well-defined clockwise disk, a less well-defined counterclockwise disk, but this is a kind of strange situation. First of all, it requires that the two disks can coexist, and you would think that the gravitational interactions of the two disks would dissolve them. Second, the two disks have exactly the same age, a few million years, and if you form a disk by some episodic process, it's very improbable that you would form another one at almost exactly the same time. So what I'd like to speculate is that we're not seeing two disks, that we're seeing a system that is close to thermodynamic equilibrium under resonant relaxation, that in the inner part of the disk, you have the phase, you have a disk phase of the resonantly relaxed state. In the outer parts, you go through a phase transition towards larger radii and then end up with a more or less spherical system, and that the lumps that you see are the characteristic large-scale structure that in long-range order that you expect near a phase transition. We have actually done the calculation involving the proper numerical calculation of the interaction energy between orbits, and then you can evaluate the equilibrium state using Markov chain Monte Carlo. This is basically a plot in which each star is represented by its orbit normal, and the length of this little streak is the distance between the paracenter and the apocenter. And you can see that at small radii, the orbit normals are in a narrow cone corresponding to a disk, and then there's a phase transition to a roughly spherical system at larger radii. This is still work in progress. We do have a second toy model in which this is a parameter that measures the initial conditions. This is the ratio of the thickness at the inner edge to the thickness near the outer edge to the thickness near the inner edge. In many of the models, it's much larger than one, which is also consistent with the idea of a phase transition. The observed disk exhibits a strong warp of about 60 degrees. You can measure that warp in these simplified models. And again, for a wide range of initial conditions, the ratio of the warp between the inner third and outer third of the disk to the thickness of the disk is roughly the factor of 4 or 5 that you seem to see in the data. So there is at least, I think, promising evidence that the disks in the galactic center can be interpreted more naturally as a result of an approach to thermodynamic equilibrium. Okay, the final subject I'd like to describe briefly is the center of the Andromeda galaxy. Everything I've said so far has focused on the center of our own galaxy. That's because our own galaxy is much closer, and therefore you have much higher resolution. However, there are advantages to Andromeda. Although it's much further away, it also has a much more massive black hole, and so the difference in resolution is not as big as you might think. It also has the advantage that there's no young stars, no recent star formation, no gas, no dust. It has an extremely clean system. It's an extremely clean system, and most of the problems that you see in the Milky Way that arise from the complex behavior there are not present in the Andromeda galaxy. Remarkably enough, the first high-resolution images of the center of Andromeda came not from the Hubble telescope, but from a project called Stratoscope in the late 1960s, which launched a 1 meter telescope at the bottom of a hanging from a balloon. I don't know how they did it, but they actually managed to stabilize this telescope so it could take images with a full width half maximum of 0.2 arc seconds, which was probably a factor of 5 to 10 better than you could do with normal ground-based technology at that stage. Remember, this was not on a CCD. They actually had a camera with film. The film was wound on automatically. They took pictures, the balloon landed, and they took the film out and developed it. It was an astonishing accomplishment. This was their image of the center of M31. You'll notice that it's lopsided. They specifically called this out, the offset of the peak brightness with respect to the outer parts, and said this could be due to dust, or it could be something that required a dynamical explanation. This is a comparison of Stratoscope with the Hubble telescope, oriented to the same scale and orientation. And you can see that Stratoscope got it basically right. Hubble found the same asymmetry, but in addition found that the nucleus was double with two distinct peaks. This is an image of the same data from Hubble. It has a number of curiosities in addition to the presence of this double structure. The actual center of the galaxy is not the same as the center of the nucleus, which is this brighter peak P1. It appears to be located at the second peak. This peak is smooth and the smaller peak is cuspy and has a compact blue component at its center, which is sometimes called P3. The first natural inclination is that this might be a binary nucleus. It might be a binary stellar system. That seems unlikely because the two peaks have exactly the same colors and exactly the same spectra. Moreover, these two systems, again, will spiral towards each other by dynamical friction. The dynamical friction time is far shorter than the lifetime of the galaxies, so this would not be a long-lived system. You can argue that the double structure is due to a dust lane across the center, but again, the colors are exactly the same. This is a NICMOS image from Hubble in the near infrared, and it exhibits the same double structure, so it's not dust either. The correct explanation actually goes back to Huygens. After Galileo turned his telescope on Saturn and discovered Saturn's rings, in fact, because his resolution wasn't very good and because the rings were such a strange structure, it took some 40 years for people to interpret the data correctly as being rings, and people came up with these various other models, like a pair of satellites on either side of the main body of the galaxy. Well, in fact, Galileo's resolution at Saturn was almost the same as the Hubble's resolution at M31. So it seems likely that the same explanation is present, that is that the nucleus has a single massive black hole surrounded by a disk of stars. The only difference from Saturn is that the asymmetry in the nucleus arises because the disk is eccentric rather than circular. The reason that this peak is so bright is because it's near the epicenter, the most distant point of the disk. Stars travel slowly at epicenter, and so that's the brightest point. The reason you can maintain an eccentric disk is because the black hole has a Keplerian potential, so the orbits are closed. This correctly explains why the P2 is at the center of the galaxy, because the black hole has most of the mass, so that's going to be at the bottom of the potential well. It explains why the colors of the two peaks are the same, because they're the same stars, just at different orbital phases. It explains why P2 is cuspy and P1 is smooth, because there's a cusp close to the black hole. And it explains why there's a separate source near P2 that's blue. It's a disk of young stars that happen to be close to the black hole. You can make quantitative models of the disk. This is the data showing the double structure. This is a model. Let me just stress that most of the noise is not noise. It's actually surface brightness fluctuations due to individual stars. So most of the rattiness and most of the differences between these two are due to shot noise from the small number of giant stars in these images. You can also predict the kinematics from these models. This is a rotation curve near the center of the galaxy. You see a characteristic 1 over square root r Keplerian rise, which then turns over due to limited resolution. But it's not a straightforward rotation curve in that it's asymmetric. The peak here is minus 230. The peak here is only plus 180. And the zero velocity is displaced from the center of the galaxy. These are data points, and the line is the best fit model from an eccentric disk model that fits the kinematic, fits the photometry, and the only additional fitting parameter is the overall amplitude, which gives you a black hole mass. The required black hole mass is about 1 × 10⁸, and all of the asymmetries in the curve are reproduced quite naturally. The data I showed you before was high-resolution ground-based data. There is also Hubble data. This hasn't been modeled as carefully, but it exhibits the same features. In particular, the asymmetry is now stronger, ranging from 200 kilometers a second on one side to 300 kilometers per second on the other side. There's a strong peak in the dispersions, which is, again, characteristic of motion near a condensed point mass. Finally, there's a set of very elegant Hubble telescope observations of this central blue point source, P3. The Hubble spectrum looks like this. For comparison, this is an A star. This is the Balmer series. You can see the same Balmer series here. It's just that the lines are broadened because of the velocity dispersion of the stars. By fitting the broadening, you can estimate the velocity dispersion, and you get a dispersion of almost 1,000 kilometers per second. This is a factor of 10 larger than in the galaxy, a factor of 7 larger than in the galaxy as a whole, but it's entirely consistent with what you'd expect if there was a black hole at the center here, basically because the closer the stars are to the black hole, the higher their dispersion will be. You can fit this dispersion to a black hole mass. You get 1.4 × 10⁸ solar masses. For comparison, the estimates from models here, which are on a length scale that's a factor of 10 bigger, or 1 × 10⁸, which is entirely consistent within the errors. So I think there's a reasonably good quantitative explanation of most of the curious features of the high-resolution images of the center of M31. Why is the disk eccentric? That's a harder problem. We do know that low-mass disks can arise naturally in a near Keplerian potential and can survive. There are simulations by Jacobs and Selwood that show such disks surviving naturally for thousands of orbits. The formation of the disk is less clear. One possibility is disruption of a cluster on an eccentric orbit. The other is an instability induced by dynamical friction from the bulge, or an instability induced by counter-rotating stars in the disk. It's somewhat less clear why the disk is inclined. The disk doesn't seem to be in the same plane as the overall equatorial plane of M31. One might think that dynamical friction should damp the relative inclination, but there are other examples of inclined disks. So. Maybe there's something there that we don't completely understand. Okay, well, let me finish with a brief summary. I think the reason that stellar dynamics near the centers of galaxies is an interesting subject, partly because it furnishes clues to how stars form in extreme environments, partly because the hypervelocity stars can actually offer a direct probe of the overall galactic potential, because to get their orbits right, you have a two-point boundary value problem, and to solve that, you need to understand the galactic potential. We also expect to see flares from tidal disruption of stars by central black holes, and understanding the dynamics in the centers should allow us to predict the rates and properties of these flares. There have been proposals that we should see dark matter annihilation signals from the galactic center. We'll get clues to how quasars and other active galactic nuclei are fed. And finally, of course, one of the most important signals from the LISA spacecraft will be gravitational waves from in-spiral of stars into massive black holes. And in order to interpret the LISA events and to predict the rates and the properties of these signals, we have to understand how stars behave close to the black holes in the centers of galaxies. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.